by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Lincoln Square Village in Urbana, with more than a dozen shops, businesses, and restaurants, including Art Mart, Art Mart Toys, Callaway Boutique, Calico Jewelry, and Boyer Drawing and Painting, producer of murals, scenic art, and faux finishing classes.
Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This morning, we're bringing you programs from the Focus 580 archive. So do remember, as you listen, we'll not be taking your calls. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with Bible historian Elaine Pagels, someone who is well known for the writing that she's done about the early history of Christianity. Today, I think it's fair to say that most Christians are in general agreement about the big things. That's not to say that they're not differences, but on questions like who was Jesus and what's the path that you follow to spiritual fulfillment, now there Christians, generally speaking, are going to agree. If you look, however, at the early years of the church, you will find that there were a range of views. People had different ideas about who Jesus was and about how people connected to God. So the question that we'll be talking about here this morning, and the question that Elaine Pagels takes up in her new book, which is titled Beyond Belief, the question is, how is it that Christianity settled on one set of ideas and rejected others? The book is in large part about one of the Gospels that didn't make it into the standard set of texts that Christians use now, the Gospel of Thomas. The book is published by Random House. It's out there in the bookstore now. It's very interesting reading. She's well known for having written in this kind of area, going back a number of years to her first book, The Gnostic Gospels. She received the National Book Critics Circle Award and the National Book Award for that. She's also the author of a number of others, including The Gnostic Paul, Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, and The Origin of Satan. She is now teaching. She's professor of religion at Princeton University, and she's joining us this morning by phone. Questions welcome. All we ask of people who call in is that they're brief, and we ask that so that we can keep the program moving. Anybody who's interested to call us is welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Professor Pagels, hello.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I'm really happy to.
Well, we appreciate it. I think maybe the place to start is to take a couple of steps back and to talk about what it is, some of the source material, and what we learned about this sort of dialogue, debate, whatever was going on here in the early years of Christianity, and the material that came from this find in Egypt in 1945, the ones that that you and other people at the time started looking at, and then for you that. It really became your life's work, and you wrote about it in Gnostic Gospels and so forth, the find of material that was found near Nag Hammadi.
Right. Well, when I first went to graduate school to study early Christianity, I was expecting just what you said, that there would be, you know, one path in the Gospels of the New Testament, find out, you know, when they were written and who wrote them. And, you know, I thought one could learn more and get closer to the early sources of Christianity. And what I didn't expect was that when I got to graduate school, instead of finding a simpler and clearer picture of the early Christian movement, my professors were reading Gospels I'd never heard of. They'd been discovered a considerable time before. That was in 1970 that I went. And they were looking at the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Philip. I was astonished. These had been found, as you said, in 1945 in an accidental discovery in Upper Egypt. They were part of an ancient monastery library. But when the Archbishop of Alexandria had told the monks to get rid of all those illegitimate Gospels and keep 27 writings, which turned out to be, not incidentally, the writings of we call the New Testament, these other texts were buried, or most of them were burned. So we really didn't know how widespread and diverse the earliest followers of Jesus were.
Hmm. Well, Let's set aside for a moment the question of why and how that decision was made that some of the material was not was wrong, and that should be gotten rid of, and we have the other. When you look at some of these texts, those that didn't make the cut, that aren't in the canon, what sort in what ways were they different from those that did make it?
Right. You know, there are all kinds of texts that people have called gospels. Some of them are legends that are medieval, you know, and some are early stories, and some are meditations on the gospel. But one of them that really has fascinated people working on the earliest Christian movement is the one called the Gospel According to Thomas, because it starts with the words, these are the secret words which the living Jesus spoke and which the twin, Judas Thomas, wrote down. And then there follow just 114 sayings that are attributed to Jesus. And many of these sayings are also found in Matthew and Luke. So they look like early sayings of Jesus, that is, well-known sayings. And others are really very different. And they're startling to us because it looks like this gospel was written about the same time as the ones that are in the New Testament.
What sort of, I guess the important, interesting thing here has to do with what Thomas says about Jesus, and particularly when you set that against what is said about Jesus in the other Gospels, the ones that actually made it into the book. That's what's really most interesting.
What it shows us is that there's enormous disagreement, as you said, about the question, who is Jesus and what is the good news, which is what gospel means. The Gospel of John, for example, says, well, Jesus is the divine light of God that came into the world, and the good news is that you can be saved from sin if you believe in him. Of course, if you don't believe in him, you're condemned. That's what, according to the Gospel of John. This text agrees with John that Jesus is sort of a manifestation of God's light come into the world. But the good news is, so are you. That is, you too come from the same source from which Jesus came, that everything in the universe came from that divine source. And it's a much more inclusive and radically different view of what the good news Jesus taught might be.
Hmm. One of the interesting and difficult questions, I suppose, about a lot of the text, a lot of the scripture, is who wrote this, and who were they, and what was their agenda, and what did they believe? What do we know, or do we know who this Thomas was?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's one of the hardest. You know, I mean, if we ask who wrote the Gospels in the New Testament that we call Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, from a historical point of view, we really don't know, and they're written down by followers of Jesus, and their sayings and stories and traditions attributed to him. This one's attributed, as they are, to one of the disciples, the one named Thomas. And we don't know exactly who wrote it, but then, you know, when you ask a historian, most will say, we don't know who wrote any of them. We do think that it probably contains some of the early tradition about Jesus, and probably some later reflections, too.
So here now we have this interesting, the central kind of contrast here in Beyond Belief is between Thomas and John. And in fact, I think you make the argument that you really think that the Gospel of John was written as a refutation of Thomas. And then, of course, later on, we know that here in around 360 something, when the standard canon was established, that someone said, "No, this Thomas, we're not going to have that.
Take that one out
to get rid of that because of what he said." So here, the essential difference is that what John is really saying in a very clear way is, "Yes, Jesus is Son of God. Jesus is God, and believe in him, and that's the path to spiritual salvation." And what Thomas is saying in this is this much more. Maybe harder to understand, also more radical in a sense, kind of view where he's much more vague about who Jesus is, his divinity. But maybe most important is this idea that the spark of divinity doesn't reside just in in him or in God, that the spark of divinity resides in everyone, and that the spiritual quest has to do with discovering it in yourself, not in something that's conferred upon you from from somebody else.
Well, yes, I don't think the Gospel of Thomas is any more vague than John, but it just simply says, not only does Jesus come forth from the divine source, but so do we all. But, you know, when we talk about John and Thomas, I think that these disciples are really associated with certain teaching traditions. Like if you say the Gospel according to Matthew, it doesn't mean that Matthew necessarily wrote it. It means that you know, you or I could have written it and saying, well, this is the Gospel as Matthew, our teacher, taught it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Gospel of John are teaching traditions about Jesus associated or transmitted through the disciple John, and the Gospel of Thomas claims to be teachings of Jesus as they came through the Apostle Thomas. And these are probably different groups of Jesus' followers. Some say, well, we know that in the earliest group, Paul says, some people say, I'm from Paul's group. Some people say, I'm from Peter's group. Some people say, I'm from John's group or Thomas's group. So these are different perspectives, if you like, on the gospel.
Hmm. Who was it that decided on which of the writings we would accept? And essentially, we're saying these writings are correct and these other writings are not. Let's get rid of them.
You know, we don't know the answer to that question because we have just no information from the people who made those decisions, whether they were groups or councils. All we do know is that in the late second century, I mean, let me just go back and say, what we do know is that there wasn't a New Testament as we know it until the fourth century. That's a long time after the Christian movement. And that there were a number of gospels that were circulating and used by Christians, and the letters of Paul and so forth. But who made the decision? We're not sure. Where that decision becomes visible is in the writings of people we call the Church Fathers, because they really are the architects of Orthodox Christianity as we know it. And what they say is John offers the correct teaching, which is that Jesus is really the only Son of God, and that you must believe in Jesus. That's the only way to salvation. And that emphasis on an exclusive way was very important for this struggling group as it established its identity and its claim to truth under tremendous pressure of persecution.
Hmm. So that, I guess, raises a number of possibilities. If you ask this question, well, why, whoever it was, person or persons who made this decision,
right,
that we're going to go with John and we're not going to go with Thomas, why they did, you might imagine a number of reasons. They could have thought, well, simply it was just wrong. They could have thought that it was dangerous, or it could, and it also could be that they just simply said, well, no, look, we've got to have a coherent set of what we all believe in for the purpose of holding everybody together, because if we're going to survive, everybody's got to sort of hang together. So it was, in a sense, maybe a political sort of concern, not so much that the ideas of Thomas were dangerous or problematic. Is it sort of some of all of those things?
I think all of those are really, you said it very well. I mean, all of those. I mean, the message of the Gospel of John is very simple. I mean, it basically says, if you look at John 3, many people quote the famous passage, you know, God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whoever believes in him should have everlasting life or eternal life. Whoever doesn't believe in him is already condemned because he doesn't believe in the name of the only Son of God. I mean, believe in Jesus and be saved. Do not believe in Jesus at your peril. That's a simple, direct message. The Gospel of Thomas has Jesus say things like, it's not about believing in Jesus, but if you seek for the divine light, if you seek for God, how do you do that? You don't just believe in Jesus, but you need to search within yourself to find the source from which we all come. And that may be obscured. I mean, we may be completely unaware, being the deficient humans that we are.
Mm.
We may not display any evidence of coming from any divine source at all. But this is about a spiritual search, which is personal and deep and difficult.
See, and I guess one of the interesting things to think about here is just how the course and character of Christianity and the way that it is practiced today might be different if, for example, someone back there in whatever year this was made the decision to put Thomas in the canon and that we wouldn't have John.
That would be very interesting because, you see, when I first met these Gospels in graduate school a couple, about 20 years ago, I assumed they were completely, you know, different from the Gospel, say, of Mark. And now I realize that my students say to me, well, why? You know, why couldn't you have both? Why couldn't you have the Gospel of Mark as the basic teaching and the Gospel of Thomas as the higher-level teaching? And when you look at Thomas, that's exactly what it says. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense if you didn't know the story of Jesus. So I think that whoever put those sayings together assumed that for them to be meaningful, you'd have to know who Jesus was and the disciples, and that this is not a teaching for everybody, and it's not a teaching for beginners. Maybe you start with faith, and then you go on to spiritual search.
And I suppose some people, if they're going to cast a jaundiced eye on this, they would say, no. But a teaching like that, this is dangerous for the institution of the church, because it undercuts the authority of those people who claim to be the leaders.
Well, that's exactly what the archbishop thought, because in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus is saying things like, when they say, well, tell us what to do, tell us, you know, what do you want us to eat? How shall we give alms? What shall we do? Now, if you look at the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, Jesus says, well, when you give alms, you know, don't let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. And when you pray, say, Our Father in heaven, you know, the prayer called the Our Father. But in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, do not tell lies and do not do what you hate, because everything is known before God in heaven. So it's like a teaching for advanced-level students in which they're not simply given a simple answer, a practical answer, but they're told, well, you have to go out and explore for yourself what the truth is and find that. And you have a way to do that because the divine light of God is within you if you'll search deeply enough for it.
We have several callers here. We'd like to bring them into the conversation, and I should introduce again our guest, Elaine Pagels. She's professor of religion at Princeton University and has written a lot about the early development of Christianity in a number of books. Her first, the one that she became known for initially, the Gnostic Gospels, that's been quite a while, but she's done some others exploring some of the same ideas, and her most recent is out now. It's titled Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, and it's published by Random House. We have some people here who would like to come into the conversation, so we'll do that in the order they came in, starting with Urbana, and that's line number one.
Yes, good morning.
Yes.
Good morning.
I have a question. The left-out Gospel of Thomas seems to have a little bit more relevance, maybe even kinship with some of the Buddhist and Hindu sacred texts, and I'm wondering if you might just comment on that. Might be a little bit more out of left field, but I was wondering, since there was a lot of trade during those times between those civilizations in those areas, I'm wondering if there might have been any ideas or religious sentiments or maybe some, you know, interplay there.
That's an excellent question. And, you know, it's interesting to notice that tradition says that Thomas was the disciple who went to India. And there are Christians in India who call themselves Thomas Christians to this day. Some people have asked whether Jesus went to India. I think that's quite unlikely for a village rabbi as he was. But as you said, in the time that the Christian movement was spreading, there were many people moving on the trade routes from Greece to India and Egypt. And we know there were Buddhist missionaries in Egypt at the time. So it's not impossible, and some people think it's likely, that there is perhaps the mingling of some Buddhist tradition with this.
Well, that raises an interesting question. Where is the evidence for Buddhist missionaries in Egypt? That sounds interesting.
Well, I know, for example, in the writings of the fathers of the church, the Indian Brahmins and the yogins are called heretics in about the year 140 by a Christian in Rome. And there's also that period of Greco-Buddhist art, which comes in exactly the period of the Gospel of Thomas.
I see. Well, thanks a lot.
All right, thanks. Let's go to another caller. This is Champagne and line two.
Yes, my question follows somewhat on the same lines. We talk of our culture as Judeo-Christian, but it seems like the origins of the church were Judeo-Greco-Roman. And I'm just wondering, well, I guess that you brought up the question, is Thomas supposed to have written this gospel before or after he went to India? And it's the question, did Thomas influence Hinduism or did Hinduism influence Greek thought or vice versa or whatever? So I'm wondering, like, I don't know that much about John and Thomas as to what their cultural background was and whether any cultural or philosophy or worldview kind of informs their gospels differently. And also, I guess this is always a sensitive issue, and I'm not up on all the, you know, I mean, you know, Greek is an Indo-European language.
Yes.
And you have certain kind of ideas that kind of run from, you know, India to Greece, you know, some kind of cultural archetypes or whatever, maybe they're human archetypes. Is there any difference between, you know, Greco, Indo-European kind of thought patterns and, you know, maybe things that were in the Jewish culture that then were kind of changed when Christianity came along with the reception of the Bible?
That's a really good and complicated set of questions. We don't know enough, at least as far as I know, to answer it well. My first hunches, like yours, are that it had something to do with traditions that we know from Buddhism. I must say now, after getting to know this text a lot better and working on it for a longer time with many other colleagues, there are many people working on this text, and we're part of a collaborative community. I'd say I now see many more of the sources of the Gospel of Thomas in Jewish tradition. That isn't to say they couldn't have many other influences, and probably do, but you could locate the Gospel of Thomas in Jewish mystical tradition, because the passages that interest me here come out of understandings of the book of Genesis. For example, saying 77 in the Gospel of Thomas, where Jesus says, "I am the light that is above all things. I am all things. All things come forth from me. All things return to me. Split a piece of wood, and I am there. Lift up a rock, and you will find me there."
Mm-hmm. Do you find any difference between John and Thomas in terms of Greek cultural influence?
They both are influenced by Greek culture. They're both written originally in Greek, as all the Gospels were. And they're both informed by Jewish tradition. I guess we're finding it very hard to separate those.
Right, and you're not. And also you see similarities between Jewish tradition and say, other kinds of Indo-European kinds of motifs.
Yes, and of course all of what we call Christianity comes out of Jewish tradition, and Jewish tradition is very much mingled with Greek, so it's probably about as hard, well, I was going to say, as to separate in contemporary America, you know, some of the cultural interplay of traditions.
Right. Okay, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, I think that's it. This point is really interesting, and I found myself thinking about the same question as you were responding to the first caller, who was listening to you talk about some of the ideas in Thomas, and saying that, well, that sounds kind of like some of the traditions of Hinduism and Buddhism,
right.
And could there be some connection? And I think, though, that the point you make now is that, well, in fact, if you look within the Jewish tradition, that is the tradition that all of these people who created, you know, who were the early Christians and who created these texts, and that what they had grown up with knowing, you don't have to go that far afield,
right,
to find these ideas. You can find them in the traditions in which they grew up and that they knew, and that it's just perhaps we're not familiar with them, but they are there.
Well, that's right, although you can't exclude, of course, these other traditions, because that society was complex, and you know, many people were coming from India and Egypt and, you know, and traveling all over the world. So
All right, we have again other callers. Let's go next to another Champagne person, and that would be line number 3. Hello.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to raise a couple of things. The first one relating to who, you know, sort of instigated putting the canon together, and the second one about a specific analysis done by Joseph Pierce in his book, Cracking the Cosmic Egg, which would seem to be very much in harmony with what you're saying about the Gospel of Thomas. I'd always heard that the canon basically got, you know, initiated in terms of putting it together by Emperor Constantine, who, when he decided that, well, okay, I'm going to use Christianity as an organizing religion for the empire. Mm-hmm. You guys got to get your act together and, you know, put together a canon. And, of course, and certain people maybe got killed on the way to the meeting to do that and other things. And you know, I don't know a lot about that, but I just wondered what you could say about that.
That's a fascinating question. I touch upon that because it's really so important. As you said, there really wasn't an established canon of the New Testament until after Christianity became decriminalized, so to speak, and that was when Constantine enacted an edict of toleration in 313 and ended this bitter persecution. One has to imagine something like the reversal in South Africa, you know, when terrible persecutions, imprisonments, torture is going on, and then suddenly it's all right to be a Christian. And when that happened, Constantine, being the emperor, wanted to ally himself with Christians. The question is, what group? Because there were many different kinds of groups. We're talking about, you know, an empire that goes from Africa to Spain to what is now France and Turkey and Iran. And he chose the group of churches that he called the legitimate Catholic Church, because they were highly organized and they were in communication with churches all over the world. And at the same time, he declared all others who weren't part of that particular network of churches, he called them heretics. And what I found quite amazing and interesting, and maybe it shouldn't be, maybe it'll be totally comprehensible to all of us in the 21st century, what he did was institute tax penalties on being a heretic and tax exemptions for being Orthodox. And with that and other imperial privileges, he strongly favored the church he called the legitimate Holy Catholic Church and eliminated, so far as he could, any dissidents.
Well, it seems like, you know, I don't know his mind, but one reason for choosing the ones that he did is that they really legitimate, you know, a hierarchical rule, whereas it seems to me that Thomas does not, which goes to the next question. Are you familiar with The Crack in the Cosmic Egg by Joseph Chilton Pierce?
I've heard of it, but I haven't read it.
Well, you probably would like to, because he goes into some depth in doing an analysis of, he doesn't go in, you know, like, chapter by chapter or anything like that, but in terms of analyzing the teachings of Jesus. But what he does actually is does a comparison between Jesus and Don Juan, the Yaqui Indian that Carlos Castaneda talks about, and their teachings, and talking about how, whereas Don Juan was a very personal thing, Jesus' teachings, but using the same process of creating or constructing reality, was a more social, cultural sort of thing that was a way of dealing with people's problems and an entire society.
Well, and certainly what, excuse me for interrupting you, but certainly what became Orthodox Christianity is practical and communal and oriented toward community formation. I'm not suggesting here that it's some kind of Machiavellian decision on his part. I think it was also conviction. But conviction and political convenience can sometimes be connected.
Well, I think the central point that Pierce's analysis makes is that what Jesus was really trying to get across was that anybody can be just like him. Anybody could perform these miracles, and this was the difficult thing he had to get across, was how people could enter into that process of constructing reality, and that then the Stoics came along and said, no, 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 you common people, you can't do that. Only Jesus could do that. But it seems to me that, in a sense, Thomas may be saying that same thing, that, you know, anybody has access to this stage of enlightenment, that it's not just the province of some, you know, church hierarchy.
Well, that's true, although it was understood to be the region that one would have to struggle for through a long process of spiritual exploration. Thank you. That's interesting.
Yeah, I appreciate the comments of the caller. I hope you'll forgive me for going on, because, again, we have a number of other people here who are waiting, and let's go to the next person, and that is also someone in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hello. You mentioned that there are a number of scholars working on these materials these days, in fact, a community of them. I note that Karen King at Harvard has just published a book on Gnosticism. I wonder if your account, your analysis, differs substantially with the one that she suggests.
No, and if you see her wonderful book, you'll see that I wrote a comment on the back of it. I'd read it in manuscript. Her book, What is Gnosticism, is a quite brilliant and extensive analysis of what we call Gnosticism and how people have talked about that since the 18th century. And she concludes that, you know, when I called these texts Gnostic Gospels, I was using a conventional kind of language. We all called them that. And now she sort of demonstrated that we really don't know what that means. I mean, that was a kind of term that people used for heretical, wrong-headed Christianity. But this may have nothing to do with historical description. And I think Karen King's work suggests that we should consider that term carefully, if not stop using it, because it doesn't really describe very much.
The term gospel.
Yeah, and I agree with her about that. I mean, I think her work is excellent.
What are the major divisions amongst the scholarly community working on these materials?
That's an interesting question. There are a group of scholars who work in the Jesus Seminar in California with Dr. Bob Funk, who are mostly interested in what the Gospel of Thomas tells us about the historical Jesus. That is, what Jesus and his original message might be. And in that group you find people like John Dominic Crossan and Marcus Borg, who focus on certain sayings of Jesus and Thomas and what they, the ways they reconstruct the original message of Jesus. I'm not doing that. I'm looking at Thomas thinking, well, it may be later than that. And I'm looking at the way that it articulates the views of followers of Jesus about Jesus. I'm not trying to say, what does it tell us about Jesus, but what does it tell us about the way the movement developed in the late second century, in the late first century, I'm sorry. And so that's one of the divisions. There are some who will still say, but this is a late and inauthentic collection and should be discarded. I mean, I was told when I started working on it by one conservative scholar that he said this was rubbish in the first century. It's still rubbish, and you know, one shouldn't pretend it's one of the real gospels. And of course, the question he did not wish to address, that the rest of us can't avoid, is, well, what makes a gospel real, or what you call real? I mean, how does it achieve that status? How did that happen?
And surely one of the things that does that is a sort of general acceptance by the community. I mean, I wonder sometimes if we think texts found communities rather than communities produce texts.
Well, indeed, that's really a very important point. And what's interesting is that in terms of the manuscript evidence, we have as many fragments of Thomas as we do of Matthew, and there's evidence that this was also used. Karen King did write an article called The Community of the Gospel of Thomas some time ago. I think it may have been used as a supplemental text of the secret sayings of Jesus, not as an alternative to the others, but as a sort of higher-level teaching. It's very interesting, though, that question you raise.
One of the significant members of the last generation of biblical scholars, Christopher Stendhal, used to say that Christianity was the religion against snobism and that the rejection of Gnosticism was the rejection of a sort of elitism.
Well, Christopher, I hope he's not a past generation yet. You know, he was one of my teachers. Of yours?
Yes.
I guess that he recently said to me when we talked about this, went to see him, his 80th birthday, he said, you know, I just thought this stuff was all weird. He said, you know, Krister, he said, I just thought this was weird. He's a professor of New Testament at Harvard. He said, but now I begin to see there's a lot more to it than that. So
yeah.
I think it's true that this was not an easily, this wasn't a simply preached message, this what you find in Thomas. It's obviously enigmatic and complex in a way.
Thanks very much.
All right,
thank you.
We have about 10 minutes left, and again, I would like to reintroduce our guest. Elaine Pagels is professor of religion at Princeton University and has written a lot about the early development of the Christian church. Her most recent book is Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas. It's published by Random House. And again, it explores this question of how is it that the accepted canon that we have today, this thing that we call the New Testament, got to be the way it is and include the material it does and exclude other material. We'll just continue to try and talk with as many people as we can. Up next is a caller in Bloomington, Indiana, on our line 4, our toll-free line. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
One of the things which makes the Gospels real is that they were unanimously accepted by the early church fathers. There is no doubt the early church fathers were unanimous that Matthew wrote the Gospel of Matthew, and they knew Matthew. They knew him personally, and they also knew Mark personally, and they were unanimous that Mark wrote the Gospel of Mark. And Luke, the language and structure of the Gospel of Luke agrees perfectly with the book of Acts. We know Luke wrote Acts.
Yes.
He opens the Gospel of Luke the same way he opens the Gospel of Acts. He is a wonderfully fine, detailed historian. The accuracy of his history led Sir William Ramsay to turn from atheism and become a Christian and call Luke a first-rate historian. I mean, in the book of John led the early church. The church fathers knew him personally. I mean, I don't know if you can get much better than that. Whereas the Gospel of Thomas, I think the earliest date we have for the Gospel of Thomas is in the middle of the 2nd century, after which all of the by the time of which Thomas certainly would have been dead. Most if not all of the disciples would have been dead. Certainly couldn't have been written by Thomas.
Well, that's an interesting comment because it's absolutely accurate what you say that the first edition of the Gospel of Thomas, published in 1959 by a group of European scholars, dated it at 140 because they said, well, this must be late because it's obviously heretical. There is a great deal of discussion among some scholarly circles. Some have dated the Gospel of Thomas earlier than Matthew and Luke, suggesting that it reflects an early list of the sayings of Jesus. I don't date it early. I think that's not very accurate. I would date it later. But as for who they knew, the Gospel of John is a real puzzle, as you well know. The fathers of the church that I'm thinking of, Irenaeus lived in the year 160 to 180 in Lyon. And that's at least 2 generations, I guess, after the author of the Gospel of John. To this day, it's hard to say whether the beloved disciple is John, although that's implied. So I just suggest that the fathers of the church that I've been looking at are living at least in the 2nd to the 4th century. And, of course, the disciples of which you speak are living in the 1st. So the question of authorship is certainly not an easy one, at least not for me.
Well, thank you very much. It's interesting talking to you.
Thank you for your comment.
Let's go to another caller. The next person is in Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Yeah, I have 2 quick questions, I think. And one is that I've heard that it said that there's some Far Eastern deity which has quite a few similarities with Jesus. Some incarnation of Vishnu, I'm not sure. But is that true?
I'm sorry, I've never heard of that.
Okay. And number 2, I was wondering if within religious studies, is there any part of religious studies that addresses the possibility of just our innate what's often called existential angst is behind religious, you know, thought, say.
Well, there's an interesting book by Dodds called Pagan and Christian in an Age of Anxiety that might address that. But your comment reminded me of something also that the previous caller mentioned, which is who wrote these texts. Just to say that there, we know from the letters of Paul that some people in the early movement, this is in Paul's letter to the Galatians, some people say they belong to Paul's group, and some say they belong to other groups, Peter's group or Matthew's group or Thomas's group. And I think the disciples in this case are figures, sort of leaders of various groups who claim to have Jesus' teaching tradition. And what becomes the New Testament has the combined teachings of several disciples in it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned that. What was that book again? Pagan and what?
That book is called Pagan and Christian in an Age of Anxiety.
Oh, so
it's a quite a wonderful book, and it does speak to that issue about that you raised.
But apparently, it sounds as if there aren't a heck of a lot of people looking at the maybe some sort of psychological reasoning behind a reason.
I think Dodds was, but I don't know of a lot of others who are. It's a very interesting. I think that could be done.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. We'll go on here to, pardon me there, I should have been quicker on the button. We'll go on here to another caller in Champaign County, and that's line number 3. Hello.
Yeah, the second time I've heard you on a talk show, and you didn't mention Doubting Thomas once.
Thank you.
I'm a doubter. I think Zoroaster is probably who the last speaker, but there, as you alluded to earlier, there are many of these stories that are all collected, and I think it's just who... It's a matter of editing all these myths. I think there may have been a historical Jesus, but the construction of it is art, it seems to me. And
no.
I also wanted to ask you about Didymus. It is, yes. Thomas Didymus,
yes.
And these people that believe that Thomas was the twin of Jesus. Do you know of any of their basis for believing that? Or
yes, I love your questions. First of all, Thomas isn't a given name. It's an Aramaic nickname. It means the twin. So
Didymus means that, you mean?
They called him, well, Thomas is Aramaic for twin, and Greek is Didymus is Greek for twin. So the man's given name was Judas. And they would say Judas, but not Iscariot, Judas Thomas, or Didymus Judas Thomas, which is sort of Greek and Aramaic, Thomas the twin. And first of all, I didn't mention Doubting Thomas because I suggest in the book that the Thomas traditions are associated with this disciple Thomas, who's just a name on a list as one of the 12 in the other Gospels. But it is John that turns him into the character we call Doubting Thomas. And he does this in 3 very deft episodes in the Gospel of John.
It's a bit of a slander, what you're going to suggest, aren't you?
What?
It's a bit of a slander of him?
It's an attack.
Yeah.
It's an attack on saying, these people don't believe anything. Thomas just, he had no faith, you know. He just was faithless. And then John does a brilliant thing in the Gospel of John. He not only turns him into the doubter, but he has Thomas capitulate to his view of Jesus, in which at the end of the gospel, Thomas says to him, now I understand who you are. You are my Lord and my God. But interestingly, Thomas, who probably was, you know, a twin, was taken symbolically by some of the people who followed the Thomas tradition as if it were a symbol for the reader discovering that the reader can be, in a sense, discover that one is the twin of Jesus. It's not that Thomas was Jesus' twin brother in some literal way, but there's a saying at the end of the Gospel of Thomas where Jesus says, whoever drinks from my mouth, which I think has to do with accepts my teaching, will become as I am, and I will become that person, and the mysteries will be revealed to him. And the idea is that when one sees that, you know, that you come from the same source from which Jesus came, you can see that on a spiritual level, not an ordinary level, that you and Jesus can understand each other as identical twins, so to speak. And so there's a symbolic meaning given to that term, Thomas the Twin. But that character only appears in the Gospel of John, and there he's always negatively portrayed, just as John always portrays Peter, another leader of the church, as second to the one he calls the beloved disciple and implies is himself, John.
There was another story, which was that John, the twins, there's a skepticism of twins, and this was another way of calling him a doubter, was to call him a twin, to be a skeptic. So obviously these are all mixed up in myth and lore, and I think it sort of makes my earlier point, which is that these are stories that we have the will to believe. I hope that's not too Nietzschean, but I'm gonna let you go because I know you want to wrap it up. Thank you.
Actually, it's William James, you know, that wrote the book called The Will to Believe.
We're at the point where, indeed, we are going to have to stop, and we have a couple of calls we can take, and my apologies. I guess just to wrap up, what makes this so interesting, and why should this matter to the practice of Christianity today?
Well, I found that I was asking myself the question, you know, what is it that I still very much love about Christian tradition? What is it I can't love? And looking at the history of it makes it more comprehensible how the tradition developed in the way that it does. And it makes it something that I find I can approach and engage without having to simply swallow it whole, as if someone says, you have to believe all of this or you can accept none of it. That is a traditional approach, but I think there are many other ways to approach it.
Well, we'll have to leave it at that. It's always very interesting to talk with you. I certainly appreciate you giving us the time. Our guest, Elaine Pagels, she's professor of religion at Princeton University, author of several books, the most recent, this book we've been talking about here, titled Beyond Belief, The Secret Gospel of Thomas, published by Random House. And again, Professor Pagels, thanks very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to a Focus 580 interview first broadcast earlier this year. It comes from the Focus Archives. If you'd like to hear some past programs you might have missed or listen to interviews from the Afternoon Magazine or any other of our local production, you can go to that website anytime that you like. It's will.uiuc.edu. We hope that you will enjoy the rest of your day. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Orange Taxi, a new taxi company providing services to the U of I campus and the Champaign-Urbana area 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at 367-8888.
A high-pressure system across the Midwest is bringing warmer temperatures to the area. In Champaign-Urbana today, partly sunny with a high in the mid-20s, partly cloudy tonight with a low around 18, and the outlook for Tuesday, partly sunny, highs around 40. You're listening to the Broadcasting Service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois, WILL Urbana. And all of us at WILL want to wish you the very happiest of holidays.